Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview with composer Steve Dorff. You would know many, many of the songs that Steve has written with a variety of lyricists, because many, many of them are hits. And you will hear him name some of the very famous, very talented people who have recorded his songs. Currently, he's the composer with lyricist John Bettis, with whom he has written many of those hit songs, of the world premiere of the musical Josephine, based on a part of the life of the remarkable, extraordinary, infamous Josephine Baker. Steve's story is in itself quite unusual. You will hear me say, with some amazement in my voice, "Do you mean to say you've not had any musical training?" And then you will hear Steve say, "No, I'm self-taught." This is a really interesting story of a really interesting man. In this show, I am not only playing my interview with Steve, but you will hear at the beginning one of his hit songs, which you will certainly recognize. And then, throughout this show, I'm going to play three other songs. They are from the production of Josephine, which opened on May 6th and is closing on May 29th. So if you want to see it, and I suggest that you do, you have to hurry up and get tickets. So hang on. Here come the show.
Really can I can't remember when you weren't there, when I ever cared for anyone but you. I swear we've been through everything there is. Can't imagine anything we've missed. Can't imagine anything the two of us can't do. Through the years, you've never let me down. You turned my life around. The sweetest days I found with you. Through the years, I've never been free. I've loved the life with me, and I'm so glad I stayed right here with you through the years. I can't remember what I used to do, who I trusted, who I listened to before. I swear you taught me everything I know. Can't imagine needing someone so, but through the years it seems to me I need you more and more. Through the years, through all the good and bad, I knew how much we had. I've always been so glad to be with you. Through the years, it's better every day. You kissed my tears away. And as long as it's okay, I'll stay with you through the years. Through the years, whenever things went, I've learned what love's about by loving you through the years.
Welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person you think you need to be. Not the person other people think you should be. Not the person someone else told you to be. The person you really are. It's unfortunate, but many of us have experiences in our childhood, either in our family of origin, or sometimes in school with peers, or the result of experiences that we had in a religious organization or a cultural organization, where we get the idea that something about us is not okay. And although some children are able to hang on to their essential self, even in the face of criticism, teasing, abuse even, most are not. Many are forced first to try and pretend that they are not this thing, which is bringing a consequence they definitely do not want, And if they're good enough at it, and lots of children are, over time they simply forget that they have this quality, this attribute, this interest, this passion, this skill or ability. It's remarkable to imagine, but many, many people come out of childhood unaware of something that is essential to them, unaware of who they really are. As a psychotherapist, I see this, unfortunately, way too often. And so, the point of the Lynn Show is to say, if this happened to you, if your childhood in some way discouraged you from being all that you are, it really may not be too late to recover something which you had to deny, which you lost access to, which you may not even know you have. Although, in my experience, we don't lose the feeling that there's something about us that we don't have access to, or something that we wish we had. And quite often, that something that we wish we had, we actually do have. It's just lost in the mists of childhood, hidden. I call that going undercover. So, in my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And the interview that I'm airing today with Steve Dorff could be the poster child for what I am trying to demonstrate. Apparently, Steve knew who he was, what he was drawn to, what was important to him in the crib. And even though he didn't get real encouragement for it and a certain amount of teasing about it or concern for him, he held on. He not only held on, but he found a way to discover his own particular approach to his passion, to what he came in with, to what he was meant to do, and of course that was music. You heard one of his many, many hits as I started the show, and I'm going to go now to a song from the score of Josephine, the show that he and his lyricist collaborator John Bettis have written the music for. And right on the heels of this song, I'm going to play my interview with Steve. So here is another example of what he held on to and how well he does it.
Does every normal guy get clumsy, shy, and stupid when Cupid makes a target of his heart? I've read Millet's Vermilion Rhymes, and I've played Berlin a million times. I've been around the block, but I'm still shockingly unsmart. Love songs are easier to sing than live through, and no matter what advice they give you, love is always a complete surprise. One day you're absolutely unromantic, the next you're absolutely frantic, and you can't explain the words or whys. First move, you shake your head and just deny it, but you know your heart's not going to buy it, so you try a little common sense. But love stays confusing as the way you found it, so you finally put your arms around it when you realize there's no defense. Am I so familiar she can't see me? Like the table where she throws her keys. Am I invisible as glass, or a mirror she can pass, where her reflection is all she ever sees? Love songs should be written like they're meant to scare you, or a travel guide that might prepare you for the little things you're bound to miss. it's too late. I should have bought her cards and flowers. I should have stood out in the rain for hours and waited for a chance like this. To put her hand in mine. And if I couldn't find a single perfect line, I could have said it all with just one kiss.
I'm here with Steve Dorff in a conference room at the Oslo, and I'm here interviewing Steve because he is the music behind the premiere production of Josephine, which will be opening at the Oslo on May 6th.
Correct.
And it's now in previews, so it's astonishing that he's taken this time to talk to me because he must be overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's been quite the experience. Tech is hell. Not fun.
No, this is where the crunch comes.
Yeah.
Right.
And we're really crunching.
You're crunching.
Yeah.
Well, wait, I want to talk about Josephine, but actually, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that the art to which you have given your life is music.
Yes,
right? And I only ask one question, and it is, do you remember the very first time in your life when music spoke to you, called you?
I do.
Yes, I can see it on your face. Tell me.
Probably in the crib.
Yes.
Yeah.
I believe it. Tell me.
I remember holding my hands like this and banging my head. My mother would tell me later that she thought there was something wrong with me, and in reality, I was hearing orchestra, and I was hearing music.
You were hearing orchestra, and you were hearing music? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any memory of that?
Not specific what it was, but I didn't even know what an orchestra was. I couldn't even talk.
Right.
I do have a memory of being about 3 or 4 years old and walking over to the piano and hitting the low keys, which represented the big bad bear, and then the high keys with the little birds. And so in my mind, those were musical sounds that represented things that I, visual things I was seeing. And so I suppose that was my first composing.
I'm sure that's right.
Yeah.
Except for whatever was going on in your mind before that.
Yeah, and I've been doing that my whole life. I mean, I remember getting in the car with my mom, and if it was raining, she'd turn the windshield wipers on, and all of a sudden the rhythm of the windshield wipers would become this. That's I was a weird kid. My friends have reminded me, that I used to ask them, how did you hear that when, someone hit a home run or someone hit me with a snowball? I would say, how did you hear that? And they'd look at me, what are you talking about?
So is this a version of synesthesia? Do you know what it is, synesthesia?
I've heard that term, and it probably is. I didn't.
Do you understand what it means?
Not really.
It means some people, it seems like what you're describing, mm-hmm. although it's not, well, I don't know, maybe there are almost certainly variations of it, so a variation. People for whom one sense is linked to another sense,
mm-hmm.
so that sound will have color.
Definitely. I used to see music, before I knew what notes looked like, I used to visually, if I was closing my eyes and humming something, the best way I can explain it are tiny plasma bubbles.
Yes.
Not notes, because I didn't know what notes were.
No, but you already had a visual sense of what that was.
Absolutely.
And so, I'm getting ahead of myself, but when you compose, are you doing that as well? When you're playing, are you seeing either colors or graphics or images? Now it's just audio now.
Well, now I don't sit at the piano and write.
Ah.
I write.
In your head.
In my head.
Yes.
But by the time I get to the piano, I've got...
You know what it is.
I know what it is. There's a song in the show called The Trains Are Running. And it's the first song of Act One. And the funny story is, when I get around water, for some reason, I write my best melodies. And I was watching my two daughters in the pool. They were like, well, it was 8 years ago. So they were 8 and 10. And I was watching them in the pool, and all of a sudden I got this idea for, oh wow, that's what the second act is. And I started singing it, and I started, you know, I started getting the whole thing in my head. I could visualize the, you know, what it was. And I realized, shit, I gotta write this down. And I can't leave my kids in the pool. So it's like, finally, I said, get out. And I got them out of the pool. They looked at me like I was crazy. I ran in the house and got some paper and wrote it down, and or recorded it on my, no, I didn't even have the app to record it on my phone back then. So I just sketched something out, and that became The Trains Are Running. So even if I have a pen, I can draw the staff and just make, and of course now with the phone, I have a little, you know, thing where I can sing something into. Mm-hmm. And, but usually the best things are the ones that don't go away, you know, that I remember, so.
And then, of course, if they don't go away for you, the chances are really good they won't go away for anyone else either.
Well, I hope.
Well, clearly that has been true. But okay, let's back up. I got you at 4 now, right? And what I was thinking of when you were talking about that, Peter and the Wolf.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I was thinking about Peter and the Wolf when you were talking about the right. Lower notes with the bear,
right?
Did you hear much music when you were a kid? Did you have stuff like that?
Not really.
Did they play the radio or the?
Yeah. Well, I do remember, you know, TV back then was black and white. Yeah. I do remember always loving anything with music in it, and you know, my parents liked music. They'd play show tunes, and I always loved, you know, listening to music. And but I do remember when I was about 6 or 7, I saw Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic, and on TV, and I just was mesmerized by that, because all the instrument, that was my first look at violins and clarinets and oboes, and hearing the different sounds and going, That's what I've been hearing.
Oh my gosh!
You know, so I was my mother thought I was from outer space.
Because they are not musicians.
No.
And they didn't understand.
No, not really. My sister, who is 10 years older than me, so we really, you know, we're a different generation. She took piano lessons and would practice the same old thing over and over for like 4 hours a day. It was making me crazy. And I would crawl up on the piano bench and play it better than she could, you know, and which, you know, she wanted to break my arms and my fingers and, you know, it'd kill me, but...
That didn't lead to good sibling relationships.
No, because she was, you know, and she sang bad. She was always, I used to tell her, you're a quarter tone sharp, and, you know, and she, you know, they thought I was insane, you know.
So you came in with this connection to music.
It's a gift. You know, any art is a gift, and I think some people are, you know, it's like, you know, I liken it to, you know, what makes Michael Jordan able to throw a basketball through a hoop better than I or you will ever be able to.
Anyone. Apparently he's the top rated.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean, people have different gifts, and I was, you know, blessed with this, or cursed with this ability to hear music and compose it.
Okay, so At some point, you must have figured out that one could do this with one's life, that it wasn't just, you know, that you sat around and heard it in your head, or you, right? So, did you take piano lessons? Did they finally say, well...
They tried. I couldn't do
it. You couldn't?
No, piano, the one piano teacher I had told my mother that I was unteachable.
Well, yeah, not that you weren't a musician, but that
he
you
would,
were unteachable.
He would want me to do it
his way,
and the traditional way with the Melba books and I just wanted to play what I was hearing, and so I would, and I think that freaked him out.
Yes. So, okay, so no piano lessons.
No.
So then what?
Just started writing songs. You know,
you started writing songs. What? You just started sitting at the piano, or you just started hearing them and then going to the piano and putting them down?
Once I was a teenager, you know, when the Beatles were a huge influence in my...
Wait a minute. Are you saying that you never had training, at least until you were a teenager?
I've never had any.
You've never had any training?
I'm totally self-taught.
Self-taught?
Mm-hmm.
My goodness. Okay, good. So the Beatles, God bless them.
They were the first, you know, and then, of course, I wanted to
be
have
them.
A band.
Yeah, right.
So I got some of my friends together, and I, you know, it's funny because I had two best friends, and neither one of them could play an instrument. So I taught my one best friend how to play the guitar, and then I taught my other best friend how to play the bass. And I didn't know how to play either one, but I...
But you know how to found the... Once you found the sun, the... Found
yeah.
the sounds,
yeah.
right?
And so we, you know, we formed this little band. We were awful, and I started writing songs for the band, and then they threw me out of the band because they wanted to start making money, you know, playing Wipeout and all the hits.
They didn't
want to
play your...
They didn't want to play original songs, and so I started writing songs and trying to figure out, okay, how do I get people to record my songs? And that was the genesis of you know, I found out where the publishers were in New York. I'm born and raised in New York.
So you're what? So you graduate from high school?
Yes.
Barely?
Barely, yeah.
I'm sure I know who you were.
Yeah.
I can see it, right? Yeah. Okay, good. Did you go to college? Did you care?
Well, my parents wanted me to be anything.
I'll bet they did.
A circus performer. And... and so I went to the University of Georgia.
Where they would let you in?
They let me in. It was a big party school, and they had a great football team, and that was my criterion because I also loved football and sports. So I applied to a bunch of schools, and I got in there, and I went there and found a piano in the girls' dormitory, and...
The rest is history.
That was it.
Right. So you.
But I did graduate.
Well, what did you major in?
Journalism. Whatever it was that I didn't have to take math.
I got it.
Yeah.
And you know they say in...
Music is very mathematical.
Yes, right.
Which it is, and that's been the hardest challenge for me, is trying to figure out, fractionalize all the things I'm hearing.
Give
because
me
it's all fractions. Well, triplets and dotted 16th notes and, you know...
But you hear them.
I hear it. So my frustration was, okay, how do I...
Well, why didn't you just get a copyist?
Well, I ultimately did. Oh, well, what I ultimately did was I went to the library and started studying scores, listening to...
Oh, this is what that is. I'm making that up, that's what you said, that when you heard...
Right.
Right.
I would look at a Beethoven score of the Ninth Symphony and be listening to it and looking at it while I'm listening and saying, ah, okay. And so I taught myself how to read music, and now, you know, I mean, I've conducted the London Symphony, which is pretty stupid because I never took a conducting lesson in my life, and I never took a music lesson in my life, but I know how to do it.
I got it. And I'm, you know, what I'm thinking, which of course is apropos of nothing, is how sad for you that you didn't have people who understood what you could do. And
I don't, You know,
don't think it would have been different if people had not said there's something wrong with you, but this is a Yiddish word, quelled for what you could do?
Well, no, my mother was very supportive of me. She knew, you know, but they didn't, you know.
No, they didn't understand. I'm not blaming them.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that this, what you are, is not...
My dad wanted, you know, they were from the Depression era. They were, you know, he wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Right.
Or,
yeah, he wanted you to be safe.
Yeah. And, you know, they both lived to see me have success. So they, you know, and that was good.
We don't have a culture that actually makes room for that.
No. No. And, you know, it is what it is. So I just wrote songs and tried to figure out, okay, how do I get Andy Williams to record this really cool song, you know, or how do I get...
Well, are you writing lyrics as well?
No. Well, I do.
No, I mean in the beginning.
Show.
No.
Oh, in the beginning?
I know that.
Oh, yeah.
In the beginning, you were writing your music and lyrics.
Yeah, I think once I was signed to a publisher, I realized the value of collaborating, because writing words was never that. I was not gifted in that area. That's a totally separate talent, and I've been so fortunate to have written with some of the great lyricists.
Okay, let's back up, because I'd really like the chronology.
Oh, okay.
So here you are, 21, and you can create these songs, mm-hmm. and you graduate from school with a journalism degree.
Right.
Yay. A lot of words.
Yeah.
And then you stay in, do you go back to New York? Because
no,
that's
I was
where
in Atlanta.
You were in Atlanta?
And I got a gig writing for a publisher, music publisher.
In Atlanta?
In Atlanta.
So you got signed to a deal, some kind of contract?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And I was married, and I had a six-month-old baby. And
starting right out.
I was making, I think, $150 a week. And
but what are we talking now? 1960?
65?
65?
Yeah.
Right?
64, something like that. No.
No, it's going to be...
No,
70. Right, 70, right.
73, 74.
Oh,
70.
The
70s. Mid-70s. I'm writing songs. I'm starting to get a little traction. People are listening to my songs. Start getting a few songs recorded. And then, you know, and I knew this, yeah, this is what I'm going to do. But I kind of got into arranging and production, record production, because people were hearing my demos and going, oh, that's cool, who played on that? And I went, you know, and because I have a style that is...
All your own.
Yeah, kind of a signature in the way I voice chords and stuff. They would say, yeah, you know, why don't you play on my record or co-produce or arrange it or produce? And so that was the evolution of the beginning of me starting to, you know, make a name for myself. And then I moved to Los Angeles in 1974 and started playing on sessions. I was doing session work. And
in 74?
Yeah. And
how long?
How long was I doing that?
Yeah.
Right away?
No, I don't mean that. I mean, how long did you stay there? And
oh, I'm still there.
You're still there?
Yeah, I still live in Los Angeles. I'm based in Los Angeles. And I started, started getting songs recorded by Johnny Mathis, by Andy Williams, by all the people that I dreamed about writing for. And then I started having hits.
And then more people wanted.
Yeah, that's the way it works.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I look back at... all the people that have recorded my songs. I mean, some of the greatest voices in this generation or any generation, you know, from Willie Nelson to Whitney Houston.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's, I've been very blessed.
Is there a favorite?
Favorite song?
Or singer or experience?
Yeah, a lot of them. I think the best, purest voice that's ever recorded one of my songs was Celine.
Ah.
Certainly Barbara Streisand. I got to produce Ringo, which was maybe the highest point ever to produce one of the Beatles, and actually push the talk back button down and say, could you do that again, Ringo? You know, that was kind of a, you know, but, you know, a lot of great artists have recorded my songs, and each one brings a unique thing to it, from Glenn Campbell to George Strait, who's a big country star. You know, I've had 3 number ones with George, and it's always there's always a great story behind every song.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so you're writing this with John Bettis, right, with whom you have been writing.
John and I have been working together for probably 20 odd years.
So how did that happen?
We were both signed to Warner Brothers as staff writers, and the gentleman who was running it at the time introduced us, said, you guys should write together. And I knew John's work, he knew mine. John had written so many hits for the Carpenters, and Karen had recorded a couple of my songs, so we knew each other. And we decided to set up a date, and we got together and we started writing songs, and every collaboration is different. You know, just like every marriage is different. It's our process has always been very, we always come up with something that it's a lot of work, but it's just, it's got this certain sound that's unique to what John and I do. And we both loved theater, and we started writing. We had an opportunity to write a project together that never went anywhere, but we knew that this was kind of in the future. And
was that Lunch?
That was Lunch, our first.
Which is in actually responsible for you having this gig.
That's correct. And John and I have had a lot of success. We've done a lot of TV themes together. He's always a first call guy for me. If I get asked to do a project, I'll call John and say, I gotta have this by tomorrow, because I know he'll come up with it, and I know it'll be.
Do the lyrics come and then the music go back or forth? You don't care?
All different ways.
All different ways. Okay, good.
Yeah, we've done it every way, where we sit in a room and grind it out, where he's worked on a lyric and I'll just come in and musicalize it, or where I have a melody and I'll give it to him and say, write this. And in the show, especially in the show, they came all different ways. Some very quickly, some, we just wrote the act closer of Act 1 in one day. I flew to Nashville. He had this idea for, we knew we needed a great song for Josephine to sing at the end of the act. And, you know, we wanted to get closer to when we were going to be here, too, because we were good under pressure. So, yeah, it comes all different ways.
So you want to talk about Josephine?
Sure. Yeah, it's a wonderful project. Deborah Cox is a world-class singer, which is great for us, because we've heard our songs in readings and in workshops of this process over the course of 8 or 9 years.
Oh, you're kidding. I had no idea it was that long.
Yeah. Where, you know, singers would, you know, greatly disappoint, you know, not be able to sell the lyric. Music director didn't really see my vision of what the song should be. Rushing through the tempos, bad arrangements, because I don't do the arranging or orchestrating for Broadway. I wanted to have that theater. That's not what I really do. And with this production, we have bulletproof singers. the guys, even the little girl in the show, I mean, they just, it's, you know, our music director is fantastic. Steve Orich, who's done the orchestrations, has done, he's done a great job. He's listened to my thoughts and beautifully translated. I haven't had an issue with any of it, so I'm very, very happy. And it's not an easy score to sing. There are some very difficult numbers, and you know, the challenge for us was to write songs that were believable or could be believable to the audience that they happened during this period of 1939.
So you're talking about writing in that genre, in that time frame.
Yeah, but we do what John and I do. I mean, we just dressed it more in that time frame, but they're contemporary songs that we feel can have a life outside of the show. So that was the challenge, and that was the goal, and I think we've done that. So we'll see.
Definitely. Yeah. We will definitely see. Mm-hmm. I have one more question, mm-hmm. but in a way, we've been talking about it. Apparently, you have given a life to this work, literally, maybe even in the womb, right?
Absolutely.
Right. Uh-huh. So would you just think for a second and say what you think that's like, what that's meant, anything that comes to mind about what it's like to have given your life to this music?
I think about it a lot. It's because it's affected every aspect of my life. I think music has, without question, defined me. And I mean, I have a life outside of music. I have children. I have, you know, I've been married twice, and so I've experienced all that stuff. You know, I still have two teenage girls that are, you know, that are I'm very responsible for. They live with me full time, and so I consider my life to be somewhat normal, but my job is creating music, and it's pretty much a 24/7 job, because you can't turn that off, you know. I can't. I've never been able to turn it off.
Yeah.
You know. So it's, yeah, when I look back at all the songs and all the, it's been a great ride, you know. It's just thrilling, you know. I mean, I don't know if you've been to my website.
I have not.
Yeah, it's stevedorff.com. And there's a picture gallery of all the artists I've gotten to work with, and that, you know, that's so much fun to just every once in a while look back at that stuff, and especially when some artists pass away, and said Merle Haggard just passed away. I got to work with Merle when Whitney died. That was, you know, so many great ones that I've gotten to work with. That's when it really kind of hits me that, wow, you know, I was so lucky to have gotten to work with them, you know, and still doing it, so.
Yeah, what strikes me is the single-minded focus of it, that, you know, I was talking earlier about how your early experiences were not, gee, that's terrific that you do that. But you were not stopped in any way.
No. No. Not really.
No.
I mean, it's a roller coaster. I think any life is. Any professional life is. You know, you have your highs, you have your lows, you have periods where you're cold, and you wonder if anybody's ever going to record anything again, or am I ever going to have another song hit the charts, or am I ever going to get this show on Broadway?
But not, am I ever going to have another idea?
No. No. That whole writer's block thing. When people ask me that, do you ever get writer's block? I don't even know what that is. You know, I think it's a stupid excuse for, I'm sure Mozart never had writer's block.
Actually, I wasn't thinking about that, but that's appropriate.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends that are great songwriters that, you know, and I guess for, you know, I'll go maybe, you know, a month or two without writing a song when I'm busy with my kids or busy with something else, but I never am not singing something or internalizing some idea where I'm going, I'll get back to that, you know. So the ideas are always, the music's always there.
Okay, so one quick, wrap up. If you could make a sentence about your career, about your life, about what it's like to be Steve Dorff, what would you say?
Three-ring circus.
They were right. Circus performer.
Yeah, right.
Right back to the beginning.
It's been a crazy ride, you know. That's a great question. Hard to answer.
So just do this for me, if you don't mind. Just close your eyes. Come on.
Okay.
Right? And just ask yourself the question.
What was the question again?
What was it like to be Steve Dorff?
Very satisfying. I wouldn't want to be anybody else, so. But I guess most people wouldn't. I've been very blessed.
It's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, Steve Dorff.
Thank you, yeah.
I've been very blessed. I wouldn't want to be anyone else. Steve says he thinks that that's true for most people, but I don't. I think lots of people harbor the wish that they could be someone else. In actual fact, they could be the person they want to be. And Steve, demonstrating what I hope you will all see as is possible, is the person he is, the person he was meant to be. And so he doesn't want to be anyone else. He's living the life that Steve Dorff was meant to live. And as I said in the opening, I play interviews with people who make their living with their life within art so you can hear what it sounds like. And so you have the opportunity to ask yourself, am I living the life I was meant to live? Can I say I wouldn't want to be anyone else? I am blessed with the life that I am living. I hope that's true for everyone who's listening, but if it happens to be untrue for you, if you have a passion that you wish you could express, if you have a way of being in the world that you don't have access to, maybe you can't stand up for yourself when you really want to, maybe you're shy, maybe you feel responsible for too many people in your life and you really wish you didn't feel that. There are so many ways in which we could wish we were different. If there's any way in which you wish you were different, and you want to talk to me about that, please go to my website, thelynshow.com, thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. Up there, there's the email tab. You can click it and ask me any questions you'd like. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can even listen to the first chapter. I'm reading it up there. You can listen to all the interviews I've ever done, including this one. As promised, I'm going to play another Steve Dorff, John Bettis song from the score of Josephine. And this is Trains Are Running, the song he talked about in the interview, how he became aware of what this song had to be while he was watching his children in the pool, and they had to get out of the pool so that he could write it, so that we could have it. And so here it is.
Paris
is still Paris, the jewel of sunny France, where the Champs-Élysées is blooming, and we still live for romance. Everything is much the same, in spite of what you've heard. To let a small invasion change our lives would simply be absurd. The trains are running, and sometimes they're early. That kind of pressure makes Frenchmen get surly. Streets are cleaner, but not quite so cheerful. We're careful when we gossip, just who gets an earful? It's petty gauche and slightly wearing that every postage stamp's the face of Goering. What a handsome fellow. The trains are running, the trains are running. The trains are running, the trains are running. Cafes are serving, but menus are rotten. Unless your passion is bratwurst or gratin. We have our salons for lively discussions. Just be careful to not quote the Russians. The Fuhrer's newsreels are so histrionic. Do you think he knows they make him look demonic? And a little crazy.
I miss the life we used to know. Long hot in warm Bordeaux, good vintage wine that is now so hard to find.
Can't live without mine sauerkraut.
Remember Camembert?
What is the French for Ubermensch?
Can you buy it anywhere?
Play Wagner, please, waltz Viennese.
It really is a crime.
No la la, just un papa.
Cadillac three-quarter time.
Everyone knows that coexistence lies on the path of least resistance. Try to ignore them, we'll get back to normal. The Louvre's nice, I'm taking home a Van Gogh. When they ask questions, be blasé and formal. Berlin is cheaper, but I love my chateau. Liberty is alive, and she's crying. Liberty, she's the one thing we're dying for. It's not a perfect situation when every day at every railway station
the trains are running.
Isn't that a remarkable song and worth getting kids out of the pool for? So what do you know about Josephine Baker? Ken Weissman, who is the mover and shaker and producer of this production, said that although she wasn't a great singer and she wasn't a great dancer, she managed to transcend her time, her race, and her gender. She was a phenomenon. She was able to hold on to who and what Josephine Baker was, despite all of the obstacles that might have stopped her, that did stop just about everybody else. Josephine Baker is a demonstration of how it is possible to hold on to who you really are. And Ken Weissman chose a particular period in her life from 1939 to 1945. Of course, that is the time of World War II. So come and see Josephine at the Oslo Repertory Theater. Come to be surprised. Come to be amazed. Come to be entertained. Come to learn what you didn't know, to appreciate what the human spirit can do and be. And of course, come to enjoy the score by Steve Dorff and John Bettis. So as always, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that you didn't know that you know now. Something that you knew but you forgot. Something that inspired you. Something that made you laugh. Something that you simply enjoyed. Something that will bring you back. Because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten limper, but I won't